VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. An intense day of Israeli strikes killed hundreds of people in Lebanon on Monday. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
It was the deadliest day for the Lebanese since Israel's 2006 war with Hezbollah. The Israeli military says these strikes were aimed at the group's weapons sites and is urging residents of southern and eastern Lebanon to evacuate before more operations.
Take this warning seriously.
In a message to civilians, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Hezbollah continues hiding weapons in their homes, and the Israelis will take action.
Please, get out of harm's way now.
Here at the White House.
We're working to de-escalate in a way that allows people to return to their homes safely.
President Biden spoke shortly after the Pentagon announced more U.S. troops will head to the Middle East. There are about 40,000 there now. The military is not saying how many more will go or what they will do. Sagar Magani at the White House.
The Israeli military said on Monday it struck about 1,300 Hezbollah targets in Lebanon.
We conducted extensive strikes against Hezbollah terror targets in Lebanon that posed an imminent threat.
Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, who said there were many secondary blasts when munitions stored inside buildings exploded. He said Israeli strikes hit long-range cruise missiles, heavyweight rockets, short-range rockets, and explosive drones. Hagari said Hezbollah put weaponry inside people's homes, claiming they intended to use the arms against civilian targets in Israel.
It's likely that some of the casualties are from these secondary explosions.
In response to the strikes, Hezbollah said it launched dozens of missiles at a military base in northern Israel. This is VOA News. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Monday urged world leaders to support Ukraine, quote, for a just and peaceful future, as he spoke at the Summit of the Future at the United Nations on Monday.
Putin has stolen much already, but he will never steal the world's future, I'm sure.
A Russian missile strike on Ukraine's southeastern city of Zaporizhia on Monday hit critical infrastructure and injured at least two people after attacks on the city late on Sunday wounded 21, regional authorities said. Russia denies targeting civilians, but thousands have been killed and injured since Moscow launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. Zelensky will take part in a UN Security Council meeting on Tuesday before speaking before the UN General Assembly on Wednesday. Survivors of sexual abuse in Belgium called on Pope Francis to take stronger action against perpetrators and push for deeper reforms in the Catholic Church days ahead of his visit to Brussels. Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn reports.
Pope Francis is set to meet with survivors and activists in the coming days while on a tour of Belgium and Luxembourg that will also focus on migrants. Catholic clergy abuse scandals have emerged in countries across the world in recent decades. More than 700 complaints and reports of abuse involving the church have been made in Belgium since 2012, according to a report by the Catholic Church in Belgium in 2022. The pontiff, who calls abuse demonic, says he's made prevention a priority. Francis created the first high-level PayPal commission to address clergy abuse. He also debuted a global system for Catholics to report suspicions of abuse or cover-ups by bishops. Survivor groups say they want to see more, including having the Pope mandate that all clergy globally must report any suspicions of abuse to local authorities.
Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn. The Democratic Republic of Congo's Minister of Justice says nearly 1,700 ill inmates have been released from the country's largest prison as part of an effort to thin out Congo's overcrowded prisons. The operation took place on Monday at the country's largest prison in the capital, Kinshasa. Severely ill prisoners received immediate medical care, while others were sent home on buses provided by the Ministry of Justice and a state-owned company, according to Congo's Minister of Justice. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Welcome to the Break Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Tanzanian police arrest dozens of main opposition party leaders to foil an anti-government protest.
They had enough police to give us security, if that is their fear, but they didn't do that. Instead, they have enough police to vandalize our protest and to arrest people.
In Guinea-Conakry, one of the key suspects in a 2009 stadium massacre has been rearrested. Senegal is undergoing an opposition political realignment as the country prepares for a legislative election on November 17. Some South Sudanese lawyers challenge in court the constitutionality of extending the transitional government's term by 2 years. Mauritanian protesters appeal to the UN to hold accountable Mauritanian human rights violators.
Since President Ghazouani is expected to be here to join the world leaders, it is an opportunity for us to come and protest against his discriminatory policies.
And Muslim Americans who flex their political muscle in the November U.S. elections. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Tanzania police upended a planned opposition protest on Monday and arrested about 50 people, including Chadema Party Chairman Freeman Mbowe and his deputy Tundu Lissu. Chadema had called for a peaceful protest as a memorial to its leaders who, it said, have disappeared or been killed under suspicious circumstances. But the police said the protest was illegal. John Mrema is the Chadema's director of protocol, communications and foreign affairs. He tells me that the party leaders were still in jail as of late Monday.
Deputy Secretary General Benson Kudela and the other 52 members have been arrested. Mr. Freeman Mbowe is still in police, Oyster Bay Police Station in Dar es Salaam, together with other party leaders who were arrested alongside with him, including Deputy Secretary General of the party, Benson Kudela. So 40 of them, they are in Oyster Bay Police Station. Mr. Tundu Lissu is still in Mbweni Police Station, and he's alone in that particular station.
Did the police say why they arrested your leaders?
They are saying that they are banned protest, but we are asking them that protest is according to our constitution and political parties law, specifically Section 11, Subsection 4. We did follow it to the dot that we are supposed to planning to have a protest on this date, the route, and where are we going to end our route. And we did exactly what the law is asking us to do, but the police, they just denied it because they are saying that, we are not sure if it was the peaceful protest. So they are doing a guesswork. And they had enough police to give us security if that is their fear. But they didn't do that. Instead, they have enough police to vandalize our protest and to arrest people, to assault Freeman's family, because Freeman's family, wife and the daughter were arrested as well. For the first time in this country since multipartism, a whole family can be arrested. We have seen it today. In Freeman's family, our wife, Dr. Lillian, when she was going out to work, she was arrested and assaulted. Freeman's daughter, she's a lawyer, an advocate of the High Court. She did appear with his father in the protest location. She was arrested as well.
So what options are available to you? What can you do?
If they cannot get a bail today so that tomorrow they can be taken to court, if they have breached any law, but we are waiting to hear from the police officers. Our lawyers have just informed us that we have to wait, so they are waiting consultations between the police and our lawyers, and then they can tell us what is it exactly.
How true is it that some journalists also were arrested along with the opposition leaders?
Actually, six, and the two from the Pashe newspaper, the second leading newspaper in circulation in the country. The first three were from the biggest news house of the country, the Mwananchi Communications Limited, which is part of Nation Media Group of Kenya. Six of them were arrested when they were covering the story.
John Raymond is the Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs, and Protocols for Tanzania's main opposition, Chadema Party. He was speaking with me from Dar es Salaam. Tanzania police did not respond to our request for a comment. The general debate for world leaders at the 79th session of the United Nations General Assembly begins today, Tuesday, in New York. Mauritanian protesters say the international community must hold responsible top officials of the Mauritanian government who are accused of human rights violations. Bakari Tandia is the executive director of the Council of Presidents of the Anti-System Coalition. He tells VOA's Peter Clotet that the international community must pressure the Mauritanian authorities to protect the fundamental rights of citizens.
Since President Ghazouani is expected to be here to join the world leaders, it is an opportunity for us to come and protest against his discriminatory policies. Besides that, killings happen. Killings of innocent people, particularly in Kayedi, my hometown. And still, those who were involved in those killings, they remain unpunished. So impunity cannot be and should not be rewarded, should not be encouraged. In Mauritania, there is a culture of impunity.
What do you seek to achieve with this ongoing protest in New York?
Number one, to increase international pressure and to keep mobilizing the Mauritanian diaspora, not only to put pressure from here and to become more engaged in advocacy and also be really active in the arena of politics.
But how effective is this? If you are bringing international attention there, a series of protests ongoing in New York due to the ongoing UN General Assembly in New York.
As you know, the fight for social change, the fight for the rule of the law is based on advocacy, community organizing, and this is how, you know, we can achieve our goals. I will give you an example. You know, today we have, you know, lawyers here who are not Mauritanian, who are helping Mauritanians. So this is an example that we are making progress because there are other people who, because of the seriousness of the situation, have decided to play their part. This is about human dignity. This is about humanity. When it comes to human rights and human dignity, there are no borders.
But the government is saying that when it comes to the issues of human rights abuses, they are addressing it, and that some of you, the opposition groups, purposefully or intentionally violate the law. And when the law is applied to you, then you cry and call on the international community to put pressure on the administration. Why do you flout the law and then complain?
You know, if they want to apply the law, they should have applied the law to those who killed more than 500 black soldiers and officers. Until now, there is no trial. You know, we have testimonies, we have documentation in those crimes.
Bakari Tandia is the executive director of the Council of Presidents of the Anti-System Coalition. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotet. Senegal is undergoing an opposition political realignment as the country prepares for an instant legislative election on November 17. The parties of former President Macky Sall and Abdoulaye Wade announced Monday that they have formed a coalition. The two parties, the Alliance for the Republican Party and the Senegalese Democratic Party, the PDS, already have 106 of the 165 seats in the national parliament. Senegalese political analyst Ibrahim Akan tells me that the realignment could pose a problem to President Bassirou Diomaye Faye's ruling Pastel Party getting a majority in November.
It was really expected because, you know, the eruption of Pastef and Sonko has really disorganized the Senegalese political system. Since 1975, when Senghor opened the door for multi-party system, it was just the opposition between the ruling party PASTEF. And PASTEF has now forced everybody to reorganize itself and to reorganize its alliances. That's the first thing. The second one is that Abdoulaye Wade hope has always been the reunification of what it called the Liberal Party, the DNA. So now it's a kind of reunification of the liberal movement in Senegal, and that was Abdoulaye Wade's wish. There is a third sector that is coming in now, which is the sector which is the alliance of those who left the Macky Sall party and the Parti Socialiste, the first ruling party in Senegal.
Currently, the opposition, I would say, have the majority in parliament. What does this new alliance mean in terms of the ruling party? What does it mean for them to get majority comes November 17?
Well, you know, usually in Senegal, when a president is elected and when he asks the Senegalese population to give him a majority at the parliament, he gets it. Abdoulaye Wade got it in 2001. Macky Sall got it in 2012. So the hope of Sonko is also to get the majority of the vote at the parliament. Now, the two coalitions that are in construction are also trying to make sure that the Senegalese vote is concentrated between two or three parties. Because if you have big number of candidates, it will be in favor of the current president. It means that Sonko's party will get the majority. But if you have one or two strong coalitions, it will mean that it will be a disputed election, because now people will have to make a choice between three. And that will be very interesting for our political landscape, because giving a strong majority to a populist party will be a big problem in Senegal, because people may think that that will lead to a kind of dictatorship.
Ibrahima Khan is a Senegalese political analyst. He was speaking with me from Nairobi, Kenya. Listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 24th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. In Guinea-Conakry, one of the key suspects in the 2009 stadium massacre of opposition supporters and the most wanted Guinean fugitive, Colonel Claude Pivi, has been arrested in Liberia. The move occurred 10 months after unidentified armed men whisked him out of the central prison in Conakry. Pivi was sentenced to life in prison in absentia at the end of the trial. Reporter Karim Kamara has more from Conakry.
The news of the arrest of the country's most wanted fugitive, Claude Pivi, has been widely applauded by many Guineans, who call it relief. Claude Pivi was arrested in Nimba, a border town in Liberia, close to the forest region of Guinea. Speaking on national television 24 hours after his arrest, Pivi explains how he got to Liberia. He says he arrived in his village in the forest region the day they left the main central prison of Conakry, accompanied by three of the assailants. He says after spending 3 days there, he crossed the border into Liberia to seek refuge. As for Jalo, the chairlady of the Association of Parents and Friends of Victims of the Conakry 28 September Stadium Massacre, says now Guineans can go to bed without fear. She accused Pivi of taking active part in the massacre. She says the arrest of Pivi is satisfying because everyone has been wondering if Pivi will be arrested again. She says thanks to God he is known around the world, and that was why he was arrested in Liberia. She says they are really happy because when he escaped from prison, people were panicking, not only the victims. She says Pivi failed to accept his responsibility for the massacre. Pivi was whisked out of prison in November by unidentified armed men and then taken to an unknown destination. Until his arrest, no one knew he was hiding in Liberia. Dr. Dansa Kuruma The president of the Guinean National Transition Council says had it not been for the collaboration of people of both sides of the borders, including Liberian authorities, PV would not have been arrested. He says the dignity of the victims has been restored.
Malgré plusieurs mois de cabale, la main a tenu sous PV grâce à l'efficacité et à l'efficience de notre système de renseignement.
He says despite several months in hiding, PV has finally been arrested with the help of the Guinean intelligence services. He says PV was arrested alive and not wounded and assaulted, which is what is important to him. He says with the help of his accomplices, PV was able to stay in hiding for all this while. Colonel Claude PV, former junta leader Musa Dadis Camara, and nine other top military officers were accused of masterminding the stadium massacre of opposition supporters in September 2009. At least 150 were killed and dozens of women were raped by members of Camara's former presidential guards. At the end of the trial in July, Claude PV was sentenced to life imprisonment in absentia and an international arrest warrant was issued out for him. According to the Minister of Justice, Yaya Kaira Bakaba, PV is now at the main central prison of Koya, 50 kilometers from Conakry. PV is reputed to be a well-trained soldier and very influential in the Guinean Army. He was the minister in charge of presidential security under Dadis Camara. He was maintained in the same post by former President Alpha Conde. It is not clear whether PV will be charged separately after his arrest or will be allowed to start serving his jail term. His lawyer is now out of the country and all attempts to reach him for comment have failed. For VOA Africa, I am Karim Camara in Conakry.
Some lawyers in South Sudan have challenged in court the constitutionality of the government's decision to extend the transitional government's term by 2 years. Wani Saltino Jada is a South Sudanese lawyer who is not a party to the court challenge. He tells me that while the petitioners have a case, it is unlikely that the judiciary will overturn the extension of the transitional government's term because South Sudan's courts are not independent.
Article 3, I think, of the Constitution, in respect to the supremacy of the Constitution and the sovereignty of the people. It's the people that mandates leaders to govern them. Through election, they can be voted in, and it means they have signed a social contract with the people for 5 years or 4 years, depending on the jurisdiction. In our country, it's 5 years. So it is illegal because it's not in line with the constitution of the country. The leaders don't get power through agreements. Leaders don't get power to govern by only a few people, the elites, gathering in a certain room and deciding, giving for themselves 2 years, extending 2 years, you know, giving themselves free penalties, free kicks. This is not how it works. There should have been election conducted, and the power to govern should emanate from the people, but not five people deciding for themselves what favors them.
What do you hope the Supreme Court will do? I mean, what do you want the Supreme Court to do?
I think that the petitioners, I'm sure, they are seeking for the postponement to be declared unconstitutional, null and void. But for me, I don't think the petitioners, according to my analysis, they will achieve what they want. Because first of all, the judiciary of South Sudan is not independent. The judiciary of South Sudan is the walking stick of the president. So for me, that petition is dead on arrival, because even the chief justice is not an individual, this is not an independent person in terms of his thinking and action. Because last year, if I'm not mistaken, he attended a political rally of the ruling party. So the same person attending the political rally is the same person going to decide in constitutional matters against the government. So I don't think that the judiciary will be acting independently as required by Article 124 of the Constitution. In fact, that is not a court. I can still further baptize it. It is like another political party. It's not a court. It's another political party who are governing. Then it will fix the government properly.
The petitioners said that the postponement is unconstitutional and they are asking the government, they are demanding that the elections be held. But you understand what the government said, that it cannot hold the election because implementing the agreement has not been done completely.
It's not that there's no time to hold election. The delay not to hold election is done intentionally right from the beginning. We knew that they will not implement and we never even thought of it. since 2018, what time exactly do they want? At the first, they created for themselves a roadmap. They call it 24 months roadmap for elections to be conducted. Now they have changed. Instead, they have avoided the word roadmap. They have rebaptized it 3 years. And 3 years is still the same 24 months. In fact, what they are playing is just politics. Because from 2018 up to now, what makes it difficult for them to carry out an election in the country? There's enough time.
Wanis Atano Jana is a South Sudanese lawyer. He was speaking with me from South Sudan's capital, Juba. Muslims account for less than 2% of the U.S. population, but as viewers Ken Fairbaugh reports, Muslim American influence in U.S. election is growing, driven largely by concerns over the continuing war between Israel and Hamas.
In the Chicago, Illinois suburb of Bridgeview, also known as Little Palestine, workers at the Kawa serve a seemingly endless supply of coffee products to the Palestinian Americans rotating through the shop.
Anywhere you go in this area, you'll see people who are visibly Muslim.
Deanna Othman teaches at the local Islamic school and frequents the Kawa. The most important issue to Othman this election year is ending the war between Israel and U.S.-designated terrorist group Hamas. The war started with the Hamas attack on Israel last year that killed 1,200 people and led to the capture of 250 hostages. Since then, more than 41,000 Palestinians have died in Israel's counteroffensive. A number Israel says includes thousands of militants.
To win my vote, I would have to see a commitment to ending the genocide immediately.
Many in Little Palestine share Othman's concerns. Cook County, Illinois, encompassing Chicago and Bridgeview, has the largest Palestinian community in the country.
Allah.
Illinois is home to about 475,000 Muslim Americans, about 3.7% of the total population.
They do make up a substantial minority in Illinois, and they tend to vote Democrat.
Tabitha Bonilla is a professor of social policy at Northwestern University.
So in Illinois, it's unlikely that they would swing an election. But in a state like Michigan, there are estimated to be about 200,000 Muslim American voters. And just for reference, the gap between Republicans and Democrats in the last presidential election was 154,000 people. So if all 200,000 Muslim American voters decide either not to vote or to not vote Democrat, that can really make a difference in a swing state like Michigan.
These are folks in Michigan that know firsthand the impact of American-funded bombs.
Leila Elabed is a community political organizer in Michigan and sister of the state's Palestinian-American Congresswoman, Rashida Tlaib.
We want to shift course on the current policy and adopt a policy that will save Palestinian lives.
The Muslim community, not just in Michigan, but in nearly every state, is more active, more involved than ever before.
Keith Ellison is Minnesota's current attorney general and was one of the first Muslim American members of the U.S. Congress.
The Muslim community has stronger political muscles than ever before and is making itself heard.
Deanna Othman says she wishes she had other options on the ballot.
I feel like the majority of people in this area do not want to vote Democrat or Republican.
The Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, estimates more than 2.2 million Muslim Americans are registered to vote in the United States this election year. It says that represents an increase of more than a million since the midterm election 2 years ago. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Bridgeview, Illinois.
And that's it for this Tuesday, September 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.